This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. On this day, 40 years ago, President Lyndon Baines Johnson appeared before a joint session of Congress and 70 million Americans watching from home on television to address the nation's turmoil over civil rights and to announce his plans to give voting rights to black Americans.
There is no Negro problem. There is no Southern problem. There is no Northern problem. There is only an American problem.
President Johnson eventually won approval for his voting rights package a few months later in 1965, just as he had won passage of a civil rights bill in 1964. What's not well known is that LBJ achieved this in part because of his behind-the-scenes collaboration with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during this tumultuous period. Nick Kotz has written a book about that uneasy alliance. It's called Judgment Days: Lyndon Baines Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Laws That Changed America. Kotz says that their little-known friendship was based on mutual respect and a shared agenda.
The most important thing that they had in common is that they both believed that this was a moral issue that the country had to address. And surprisingly, King was also a very good politician, just as we know Johnson was.
The two men were so close that they actually exchanged phone calls on a semi-regular basis, and the president actually called Dr. King on his birthday.
He did indeed.
Hello? This Lyndon Johnson. I had a call from you, and I tried to reply to it a couple of times.
This was January 15th, 1965. Dr. King had just turned 36. The president called, congratulated him, and then really a remarkable conversation takes place in which these two leaders are advising each other about how to deal with this situation.
We're on the way now toward the great divide. I'll tell you what our problem is. We've got to try with every force at our command, and I mean every force.
They are like two old friends conspiring together about how they're going to get voting rights through the Congress.
It's so important to get Negroes registered to vote in large numbers in the South, and it will be this coalition of the Negro vote and the moderate white vote that will really make the new South.
That's exactly right. I think it's very important that we not to say that we...
This was a relationship that was based on need.
Yes, it was indeed. Johnson needed King to draw the support for these laws. King needed Johnson because Johnson had the ability to get them through Congress.
By 1965, their relationship was strained almost to the breaking point. Earlier that March, civil rights demonstrators in Selma were beaten by Alabama state troopers. The event that came to be known as Bloody Sunday made front-page news across the globe, and it created sharp challenges for the president and the civil rights leader.
The challenge President Johnson faced was, first, how to deal with the crisis in Selma. One way to deal with it, which was being urged upon him, was simply to send a couple of divisions of federal troops with rifles and bayonets to Alabama. Johnson resisted that. He said, if we make these people recognize the most basic right, which was the right of black Americans to vote, at the point of a gun, it's not going to work. But if we do this peacefully, the American public, including Southerners, will accept it.
And the challenge for Dr. King, we should note that he was not at the first march at the Eben Pettus Bridge.
Dr. King's challenge was he was under great pressure from the young radicals in the movement, the militant but very important organizers from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, to march again 2 days later on Tuesday. But Dr. King, number one, didn't want violence. Number two, he did not want to challenge a federal court order.
President Johnson, despite his warm relationship with King, was troubled by the escalating demands and growing impatience from those in the civil rights movement. That frustration is captured in taped telephone conversations Johnson had with White House aides.
This, and he better go to behaving himself, or all of them are going to get put in jail.
After the Selma demonstration was halted by violence, civil rights leaders were determined to march again, this time going all the way to the state capitol in Montgomery. Johnson feared another march would spark another round of violence unless he called in federal troops to protect the demonstrators. But Johnson knew his political rivals would accuse him of siding with civil rights agitators. King, too, was ambivalent, fearing that more violence would ignite the most radical wing of the civil rights movement. Under mounting political pressure, Johnson came up with a compromise.
President Johnson called up former Governor Leroy Collins, who had joined the administration to work on civil rights. And he said, "Governor Collins, you've got to get down there." Governor Collins arrived at the home in which Dr. King was staying, a friend of his, came out in his pajamas and a robe. And Collins said, "Dr. King, we've got an idea that we can avoid bloodshed. What we would like you to do is to lead the marchers to the middle of the bridge, to stop before you reach this phalanx of state troopers and deputies, to kneel in prayer, to sing your songs, and then to turn around and walk back. And if you do that, we believe we have assurances from Governor Wallace and the troopers that there will be no violence." Martin Luther King responded to Governor Collins, "I'll try to do that, but I don't know whether they will follow me or not."
"You are ordered to stop. Stand where you are. This march will not continue."
Dr. King, when he got within 30, 40 yards of the troopers who were standing at the ready, he did kneel, and he did pray, and he called on several clergymen that were with him to lead prayers.
"Because we know that America was founded on the principles that all men are created equal, not just white men, but all men."
They rose, they sang, "We Shall Overcome," and then Dr. King turned and started walking back across the bridge.
But before he started walking back, something extraordinary happened. As they stood, the Alabama State Troopers sort of cleared the path. They sort of moved to the side of the road, opening up this clearing for the marchers to move forward if they chose.
Yes, and this was another very tense moment, because it revealed to Dr. King that perhaps Governor Wallace was tempting him or taunting him to go ahead and march across the bridge. If he was, Dr. King wasn't about to take that bait. He turned and led the marchers, and they did follow him peacefully back into Selma.
The plan worked, but neither Johnson or King felt fully victorious. Johnson was presiding over a deeply divided nation, and Dr. King still faced a revolt from within.
Dr. King, after he had done this, and it was really very courageous for him to do it, he was chastised unmercifully by the young militants. They were calling him DeLaude and an Uncle Tom.
But President Johnson also saw a window of opportunity. America's divisions were diminishing the country's standing in the world. Johnson decided the time was right to introduce voting rights legislation. He arranged to speak to Congress at 9 p.m. on Monday, March 15th.
He went to Capitol Hill and delivered what historians have called one of the great presidential speeches in American history. And it was as important in its way as was the symbolism of Bloody Sunday.
"Rarely are we met with a challenge, not to our growth, our abundance, or our welfare, or our security, but rather to the values and the purposes and the meaning of our beloved nation. The issue of equal rights for American Negroes is such an issue. And should we defeat every
enemy? Dr. King was down in Alabama.
And should we double
He had told the president he couldn't come because he was delivering a memorial service that day.
He was actually invited to come and
watch the speech
in Washington.
Oh, yes, he was invited to come. And he wanted to come, but he was doing a memorial service in Alabama for one of the civil rights people who had been killed. So he was sitting in the living room of a friend listening to Johnson's speech on television.
Their cause must be our cause, too. Because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
And when Johnson delivered that line, "And we shall overcome," according to John Lewis and Andrew Young, tears came down King's eyes. Dr. King was not a person who cried, but he was touched. And after the speech was over, Johnson got back to the White House. Dr. King called him up on the telephone to thank him. And Johnson said, "It is the Negro people who need to be thanked because they have brought about this victory." Both of these men were aware that they were playing important roles in American history.
Nick Kotz is the author of Judgment Days, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Martin Luther King Jr., and the Laws That Changed America. A week after President Johnson introduced his voting rights legislation, thousands of civil rights demonstrators did march from Selma to Montgomery. The Johnson-King relationship, the phone calls and the back-channel communications, could not withstand the times. As anger exploded into riots in America's inner cities, and as Dr. King increasingly criticized the Vietnam War, the unlikely alliance became increasingly uneasy. Eventually, it unraveled altogether. By the time Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968, the two had long stopped speaking to each other. Their friendship had ended, but their shared legacy lives on.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.